Lowe's knows how to turn big plans into real results. Whether it's new appliances or a home refresh, get started with 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more with a My Lowe's Rewards credit card, January 15th through the 30th. So you can invest in your upgrade now and pay over time. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payment required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we take a stack of source material on a subject you think you know and, well, pull out the surprising insights. Today, we are putting on our absolute best clothes, checking the Royal Doulton with the hand-painted periwinkles. Definitely checking those. And making sure the car is perfectly clean because we are diving deep into the phenomenon that is keeping up appearances.
And we are going well beyond just Hyacinth's executive-style candlelight suppers. The sources we've looked at, they reveal something pretty astonishing about this, you know, beloved BBC sitcom. It was, get this, by 2016, BBC Worldwide's most exported television program ever, selling nearly 1,000 times to overseas broadcasters. Think about that.
Wow.
That kind of global reach for a show that feels so very British. Well, it says a lot about how universal social anxiety really is, doesn't it?
It's incredible, truly. That export success just proves the whole premise works everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the story of the eccentric, snobbish, middle-class social climber, Hyacinth Bucket, who, and we always have to remember this, insists her name is pronounced Bouquet.
Exactly. And our mission today really is to unpack the paradox right at the heart of the show. We've synthesized loads of details on the careers, the surprises, the often quite high drama backgrounds of the core cast. We're finding Patricia Routledge, Clive Swift, Josephine Tucson, Jeffrey Hughes, Judy Cornwell, and yeah, both actresses who played Rose.
Right.
So we're asking, how much truly extraordinary, like classical theatrical pedigree was crammed inside that beat up old Ford Cortina or, you know, waiting nervously by the white slimline telephone?
So for you, our listener, this deep dive is going to show you that the performers we maybe associate with working class scruckiness or those trembling suburban nerves, they were actually, in many cases, titans of the stage. Real high-drama actors. Let's start right at the epicenter of all that aspiration. The lady of the house herself. When you picture Hyacinth, you immediately see that perfectly coiffed hair, don't you? And clothes. Always driving for that sort of smart casual at a minor royal garden parties vibe. And of course, that very strained RP accent, which famously cracks into this harsh northern sound when she's properly flustered or maybe shouting at Richard.
Oh, that crack in the accent, it's pure gold. It's the key to the comedy, really. It's all about the constant performance of superiority that Hyacinth maintains. She tries so desperately hard to project it onto everything she owns, everything she touches. Think about her obsession with her dinnerware. She's completely fixated on her Royal Doulton china with the hand-painted periwinkles. And then there's the Royal Worcester double-glazed Avignon china.
All right.
And that signature telephone greeting, the bouquet residence, the lady of the house speaking. It's like she's trying to solidify her status just by repeating it. The whole character is just a masterclass in social insecurity, but, you know, dressed up as snobbery.
And what makes Patricia Routledge's performance just so, so brilliant is that she managed to keep up that strenuous kind of brittle delusion for 5 whole seasons. But what's really astonishing, especially given how much we only think of her as Mrs. Bucket now, is the sheer depth of her actual artistic background, her pedigree. This existed long before she ever poured tea at an executive-style candlelight supper.
It really speaks volumes about the caliber of acting talent they had on that show. Routledge wasn't, you know, just some sitcom actress. She was an actress with a really serious foundation in classical theater. And musical performance, too. Her professional stage debut, way back in 1952, Liverpool Playhouse. She was trained, properly trained, across the whole spectrum of dramatic art.
And she had an amazing voice, didn't she? It wasn't just the acting chops. She was a genuine musical talent.
Absolutely. A formidable mezzo-soprano contralto range. And she used it a lot, both in the West End and significantly on Broadway. When she decided to move from straight acting into musical theater, apparently she became this immediate success overseas.
You mentioned Broadway, and we're not just talking a small part here, are we? This was like major recognition, top tier.
Oh, we are talking about winning a Tony Award. Yes, Routledge made her Broadway debut in 66, just 2 years later, boom. 1968 Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical. That was for playing Alice Challis in Darling of the Day. Now, the show itself, it was a bit troubled, closed really quickly. But Routledge's performance, everyone agreed, it was undeniable. She actually shared the award with Leslie Uggams that year. The contrast is just wonderful, isn't it? The woman terrified of dropping a biscuit was a validated Broadway star.
So the Tony wasn't enough. What about back in the UK? Any other big awards for her stage work?
Oh, yes, just as decorated back home. Across the pond, she got the 1988 Olivier Award for Best Actress in a Musical. That was for playing the old lady in Leonard Bernstein's Candide. Now that role, the old lady, it demands enormous dramatic range, serious technical control. Critics at the time, they were just raving. One said she brought the house down singing I Am So Easily Assimilated. So you've got decades of really high-level musical theater work way before Hyacinth even existed.
And she also did time with the Royal Shakespeare Company,
right?
And found success away from just comedy and musicals, that versatility. The sitcom doesn't always show that side.
No, it doesn't. But her ability to just pivot between high comedy, serious musical theater, straight drama, it's extraordinary. Take Alan Bennett's Talking Heads monologues. She was nominated for a BAFTA TV Award for Best Actress for A Lady of Letters back in 1988. Now, that's a role needing deep psychological work, not just, you know, funny walks.
And crucially, I think, for a lot of UK viewers, the work she did immediately after KUA defined her just as much.
Definitely. She transitioned straight into the lead role in the detective series Hetty Wainthrop Investigates. That ran from 96 to 98. The character Hetty, sort of ordinary seeming on the surface, but actually really sharp solving local crimes. It was another hugely successful role for her. And it let Routledge show her range again, moving from the big, broad farce of Hyacinth to something much more restrained, character-driven mystery.
So it's amazing then, isn't it, that a show with that kind of global momentum, keeping up appearances, only ran for 5 series, 44 episodes, finished in 1995. You'd think that it kept that cash cow going for years and years.
Well, the ending was totally down to Routledge herself. And this really speaks to her, I think, profound understanding of legacy, career control. She made it absolutely clear she didn't want, you know, the Tony and Olivier winner to be permanently boiled down to just being remembered as Mrs. Bucket.
That sounds almost like a philosophical stance. Art versus fame.
It really was. She specifically said she wanted to leave on a high. She consciously followed the example of Ronnie Barker, the comedy legend, who retired when his shows were still massively popular. Her feeling was, basically, it's much better for people to ask, why did you stop? Rather than, oh, is that still running?
Yeah.
And interestingly, she also offered a bit of a professional critique of the writing itself. She hinted she felt the writer, Roy Clark, was maybe starting to recycle some old ideas near the end. She thought the quality might be about to dip. So that decision, really born out of artistic integrity, is probably why the show has kept such a tight, high-quality reputation.
And even though the show finished nearly 30 years ago now, she still talks about it, doesn't she? Sort of cementing the association, but also reminding everyone of her longevity.
Exactly. In 2023, she took part in that Channel 5 retrospective, 30 Years of Laughs. And then just this year, 2024, the BBC did a special. Dame Patricia Routledge remembers keeping up appearances. She's 97 now, still managing that narrative, acknowledging the role that made her globally famous, but making sure we all understand the serious artistic depth behind it all.
Okay, so if Hyacinth is the overbearing heart of the show, her husband, Richard, played by Clive Swift, he's got to be the long-suffering backbone, hasn't he? He's that reluctant passenger, always being dragged off to stately homes, just desperately hoping to avoid any kind of social interaction.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful study in just quiet resignation.
Richard's whole life is basically defined by trying to keep Hyacinth happy while, you know, subtly undermining her through sheer exhausted compliance. He worked in finance and general purposes for the council,
right,
which Hyacinth hilariously frames as him being a power and local authority. When in reality, he's just this overworked local government guy counting down the minutes to his mandatory early retirement. And he's the one who keeps slipping up, isn't he? Calling the family Bucket until Hyacinth gives him that look.
Huh, yes. And just like Patricia Routledge, Clive Swift's comedy persona, that sort of worn-down weariness, it was built on an incredibly serious foundation in high drama. The sources show he shared that same deep theatrical background.
Absolutely. Swift was another one with serious classical training. He performed extensively with the Royal Shakespeare Company, the RSC, very prestigious. He was steeped in Shakespeare, did countless stage productions long before KUA ever came along.
His film list is quite something, too. It's a real mix. Goes from Shakespeare right through to, like, horror.
It's a remarkable range, yeah. On the classical side, you've got him playing Snug in Peter Hall's 1968 film of the RSC's A Midsummer Night's Dream. He was alongside huge names like Helen Mirren, Diana Rigg. Then later, he took on that big mythological role, Sir Ector King Arthur's adoptive dad, in John Borman's epic 1981 film Excalibur. That tells you something about the kind of serious weight he carried as an actor.
And then there's his work in classic horror, which is maybe the most surprising link to Richard Bucket.
Yeah, for fans of classic British TV, Swift is also kind of a key figure in those brilliant BBC ghost stories for Christmas. Based on M.R. James's creepy tales, he played Dr. Black in The Stalls of Barchester, and also a warning to the curious to go from delivering that kind of subtle chills in those really atmospheric dramas to playing a man terrified his wife might sing at the vicar. That's range.
He also popped up in Doctor Who later on, and there's that fantastic, slightly grumpy story about his second appearance in 2007, isn't there?
This anecdote is just peak Richard Bucket. Swift was in the 2007 Christmas special, Voyage of the Damned. Around the time it aired, he gave an interview to, I think it was Doctor Who magazine, but instead of being all enthusiastic, you know, promoting it, he gave this famously grumpy interview, complained about not getting paid extra his words, not getting paid to promote the episode. He even sort of lightly belittled the show, suggesting it was a bit beneath him, just displaying that classic weary, almost resigned irritation that was Richard. He retired from acting about 10 years later, 2017, after doing an episode of Midsommar Murders, stayed true to that slightly cantankerous, brilliant persona right to the end.
Okay, so from the long-suffering husband, let's pivot to the equally long-suffering neighbor, Elizabeth Liz Warden, played by the wonderful Josephine Tusin. Liz is basically Hyacinth's emotional coffee-spilling punch bag.
Liz's main job in the show, comically speaking, is crucial. She's the neighbor, the reluctant confidant whose nerves just completely shred the second she walks into the bouquet house. Her sheer anticipation of Hyacinth's social intensity always leads to disaster, doesn't it? Spilled coffee, dropped biscuits, and that constant terror of smashing the precious royal Dalton china, usually on Hyacinth's Burmese rug. Tusin had to nail that high-strung, perpetually trembling anxiety, and she did, flawlessly.
And Tusin's career, again, it stretches across multiple eras of British comedy. She was also a really seasoned pro long before she started spilling tea all over Mrs. Bouquet's sofa.
Oh, she was a true stalwart of British TV. Her career went right back to the 1950s. She had significant roles in classic shows like Z-Cars, appeared regularly in The Dick Emery Show. And importantly, she was Jane Travers and Ronnie Barker's very last starring TV role before he retired the sitcom Clarence in 1988. So that's a direct link to the absolute top tier of British comedy. She was also Mrs. H in the popular 80s sitcom Shelley. Lots of people remember her from that.
And Roy Clark, the writer of KUA, he clearly rated her because she followed him straight into another huge show, didn't she?
Yes, that connection continued. After KUA finished, Clark brought her into Last of the Summer Wine. She appeared semi-regularly as Miss Lucinda Davenport from 2003 right up to 2010. She also kept up a stage presence after KUA. She launched her own successful touring one-woman show, still keeping up appearances, capitalized on the fame, obviously, but gave her control over her own material. That ran from 2012 right up until 2019.
We should probably also mention that interesting parallel between Liz and Hyacinth about the unseen relatives. It's a neat recurring thing in the series.
It's a brilliant structural device, actually. Hyacinth's son, Sheridan, never seen, Liz's daughter, off at university, and her husband working abroad. Also totally invisible. They just exist as sort of status symbols or maybe plot devices.
And what does that tell us about Hyacinth and Liz's relationship?
Well, for Hyacinth, Sheridan is this constant source of bragging his supposed intellectual prowess at, well, the Polytechnic. Yeah. But he's also this constant source of financial worry for Richard, who's always having to secretly wire him money for his latest creative needlework course or whatever it is. And it's strongly implied, isn't it, that Sheridan and his roommate Tarquin are more than just friends. A reality Hyacinth seems blissfully or maybe deliberately unaware of. She insists they have a psychic connection. For Liz, well, her daughter being at university gives her one tiny, rare moment of feeling slightly superior to Hyacinth, whose son is only at a polytechnic. So yeah, the unseen relatives are just more weapons in the ongoing social war between them.
Okay, now let's cross the tracks, metaphorically speaking, and step into the world of Hyacinth's greatest shame, her sister Daisy and Daisy's husband Onslow. Jeffrey Hughes is Onslow. He's just the perfect bone idle foil to Hyacinth's frantic energy.
Onslow is the absolute embodiment of anti-aspiration, isn't he? He's proudly unkempt, a total slob, perpetually parked on that sofa in his string vest. usually got a racing paper and a can of beer nearby. He drives that famously clapped-out Ford Cortina that always backfires loudly.
Oh, the Cortina.
Which, just the sound of it arriving, sends Hyacinth into fits of social embarrassment. The great irony, of course, is that Onslow and Richard get on like a house on fire. They share this deep bond over just wanting some peace and quiet.
And Hughes brought massive pre-KUA fame to that role. He was already a huge TV star, especially from the world of soap operas.
Oh, a genuine household name. He first got famous nationally playing the bin man Eddie Yates in Coronation Street. Appeared all through the 70s and 80s. That was his defining role for a whole generation. After KUA, he kept his hand in successful working-class comedies, too, playing the lovable rogue Twiggy in The Royal Family from 98 to 2008.
He just had that perfect mix of, like, rough charm and brilliant comedic timing. It let him jump between genres pretty effortlessly.
Absolutely. Beyond sitcoms, he also moved into detective drama. He got a recurring role as the sort of lovable con man and dodgy businessman Vernon Scripps in the long-running ITV drama Heartbeat. He starred in that from 2001 to 2005, so that ability to switch from soap to sitcom to period drama, it really shows his versatility. And we should mention his unique voice acting gig, too. He was the voice of Paul McCartney in the Beatles' 1968 animated film Yellow Submarine.
That is a great bit of trivia. I did not know that. But the most unique thing about his post-KUA legacy has got to be that bizarre American TV special. Tell us a bit more about that.
It's a truly remarkable piece of, I don't know, commercial genius. In 2008, Jeffrey Hughes actually reprised the role of Onslow for a clip show made for American Public Television. It was called Life Lessons from Onslow. The premise was, somehow, Onslow had been elevated to become an Open University lecturer, teaching a credit course on, wait for it, successful relationships.
The king of doing absolutely nothing, lecturing on relationships. What was the actual content?
Well, it mostly used classic KUA clips, but Onslow provided this absurd, completely deadpan voiceover commentary. The humor came entirely from the irony of him giving out wisdom while lounging about in his vest. He basically advocated for low expectations, minimum effort, and the importance of having a good, reliable spouse like Daisy, who, crucially, doesn't demand too much. It was perfect meta-comedy, really. It highlighted how his character, despite being Hyacinth's absolute nightmare, had actually achieved a kind of domestic bliss just through apathy.
And beside Onslow, of course, we have his wife, Daisy, played by Judy Cornwell. She's Hyacinth's cheerfully down-to-earth sister, happy with her lot, which for Hyacinth is probably the biggest sin of all.
Daisy's the total opposite of Hyacinth's entire life philosophy, isn't she? She's easygoing, completely unambitious, just enjoys her life with Onslow. Her mere presence, especially when she unexpectedly appears in her dressing gown outside the Bouquet residence, causes Hyacinth severe social panic attacks.
Judy Cornwell also has this really surprising, almost bohemian backstory that seems worlds away from the suburban Daisy.
Her early life was incredibly colorful, yeah. Before she got into acting properly, Cornwell was actually a professional dancer and comedian as a teenager. And this wasn't just local talent shows. She performed acts at the Irving Theatre Club in London. The source material actually reveals her comedy routine was often performed in Soho, specifically between the nudes.
Wow, between the nudes. Imagine that contrast. The cheerful, slightly frumpy Daisy used to be a comedian performing alongside burlesque acts. That's amazing.
It's a phenomenal piece of trivia, isn't it? She also had some significant film roles, too.
Right, I think I remember one.
Yeah, probably best remembered by families for playing Anya Claus, Santa's wife, in Santa Claus, the movie back in 1985. And later in her career, after KUA, she went back to the stage, moved away from comedy more into mystery. She became quite a popular choice to play Agatha Christie's Miss Marple in various touring stage productions. She did A Murder Is Announced, which toured a lot between 2015 and 2016. So again, you see this incredible ability to switch genres across pretty much the entire core cast. #, #Forchester, the sisters, the musician, and the production nuances.
Okay, so completing the sister trio is Rose, the third sister who's, let's say, very active social life is the source of Hyacinth's deepest, most existential embarrassment. What many casual viewers might not realize is that two different, very talented actresses actually played Rose.
That's right. The role was first played in Series 1 by Shirley Stelfox. And Stelfox had quite an interesting background herself. Notably, she played the $2 prostitute in that really powerful 1984 film version of Orwell's 1984. She had a definite edge, which really suited Rose's character. But Stelfox left KUA after just the first series because she had a prior commitment to another show, the drama series Making Out.
And the actress who replaced her? Well, she brought a pedigree that could almost rival Patricia Routledge's. This might be the biggest theatrical bombshell in the whole show's casting.
It truly is, yeah. From series two right through to the end, Rose was played by Mary Miller. And Mary Miller was a classically trained singer, a genuine opera and musical theater star. She had a really significant West End career.
Okay, tell us about that West End career. What were her big roles?
Well, she was basically a cornerstone of the modern West End musical. Mary Miller originated the role of Madame Giry, you know, the mysterious ballet mistress.
Wow.
In the original London production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera, she took the stage in 1986, was part of that original cast, and her voice is on the original London cast recording forever. She stayed in that role for 4 years, from 86 right through to 1990.
So let me get this straight. We have the Tony winner Patricia Routledge and the original West End Madame Giry, Mary Millar, playing these socially awkward sisters, arguing over candlesticks and men in a, you know, fairly standard BBC sitcom. That level of talent packed in there is just astounding.
It is a profound concentration of excellence, isn't it? And Millar followed up Phantom by playing Mrs. Potts in the London production of Disney's Beauty and the Beast in the late 90s. The fact that the three main female leads, Routledge, Tucson, and Millar, all shared this incredible background in serious stage work, musical theater, it just elevates the light farce of KUA into something really quite special.
Let's turn to the other main supporting player who really defined that suburban panic, Emmett Hopsworth, played by David Griffin. He's the musician who moves in with his sister Liz, only to live in constant crippling fear of Hyacinth's terrible singing.
Oh, Emmett's constant visceral panic. It's one of the show's most reliable running gags, isn't it? His catchphrase, often just communicated through terrified looks at Liz, is basically, "She'll sing at me." And Hyacinth, completely oblivious to the sheer terror she inspires, interprets his fear as, well, infatuation. She's perpetually trying to get a part in one of his amateur musical productions, bursting into these wildly out-of-key, ear-splitting soprano notes whenever he's around. He literally tries to hide behind furniture to avoid her.
Griffin was another familiar face, wasn't he? Pulled from that same well of BBC comedy talent.
He was indeed. Before he was the tormented musician Emmett, David Griffin had made his name in that other beloved sitcom, Heidi High. Remember the holiday camp? He played squadron leader Clive Dempster DFC from 1984 to 1988. So again, it just highlights how good the production team was at casting actors who people already knew and loved for playing certain types of comic characters.
And beyond these core roles, the supporting cast really created that whole textured world of aspiration and embarrassment that Hyacinth had to navigate.
Exactly. The family dynamics are rounded out by the senile father, Daddy, played by George Webb. He's constantly exhibiting just bizarre and embarrassing behavior, you know, having WWII flashbacks or getting into awkward situations with local women. Behavior Onslow just brilliantly sums up as barmy.
And then there are the relatives Hyacinth does boast about, the almost mythical Violet and Bruce.
Ah, yes, they are the aspirational ideal, aren't they? Hyacinth is constantly going on about Violet's Mercedes, her swimming pool, and crucially, the fact she has room for a pony. Yet even their social standing is always subtly undermined by the eccentricities of Violet's husband, Bruce. Bruce is a turf accountant, a bookie which is already slightly dodgy in Hyacinth's world, and he's a cross-dresser with a particular fondness for equestrian gear. That's the bit Hyacinth conveniently leaves out when she's boasting. The whole supporting cast just functions to either boost Hyacinth's status, like Violet's house, or completely demolish it, like Daddy, Onslow, and Rose.
Now, shifting behind the camera for a moment, the sources reveal there was actually a surprising amount of tension between the man who wrote all the words and the man who had to put them on screen.
Yeah, the creative friction between the writer, Roy Clark, and the producer-director, Harold Snowd. It's documented in the Comedy Connections documentary, and it's a really fascinating bit of backstage drama. Clark was famously quite detached from the actual production. He insisted on only writing. Apparently, he rarely, if ever, visited the set or went out on location shoots.
That sounds like a potential nightmare for a director trying to stage scenes in real houses or, you know, out on the street.
It was an immediate problem, yeah. Snowd had to be there, on the ground, making scenes work within the real-world constraints of the locations, the budget, the schedule. This often meant he had to make small rewrites to dialogue or adjust the staging slightly just to fit the physical reality of filming. And this process apparently absolutely infuriated Clark. He saw any change to his script, no matter how minor, as some kind of artistic violation. He felt Snowd was just being difficult.
So you've got this brilliant writer who refuses to engage with the practicalities of production and a brilliant director who has to make the show work technically. How did they actually resolve that deep creative conflict?
Well, eventually they had to bring in a third person, a script editor. And this person's sole job, basically, was to mediate, to communicate changes and opinions back and forth between the two men. This script editor effectively became a diplomat, smoothing over the practical necessity of Snode's tweaks and then communicating them carefully back to the protective and maybe slightly sensitive Clark. It's pretty remarkable, isn't it, that one of the world's most successful and smoothly running sitcoms needed that kind of intricate managed communication just to keep the whole creative process from grinding to a halt. Hashtag tag tag five. Spinoffs, prequels, and unfulfilled potential.
Okay, so the huge global success of KUA naturally led to people wanting to revisit the characters, the whole concept. In 2016, Roy Clark came back to write that prequel, Young Hyacinth.
That's right. It was a one-off special intended to show the roots of Hyacinth's social climbing. Set about 40 years before the main sitcom, sort of early post-war era, they cast Carrie Howard as the 19-year-old Hyacinth. The idea was to show how her background bred that really intense social desperation we see later.
What were the main things they established about Young Hyacinth in that prequel?
Well, it basically confirmed that her strenuous efforts to manage her family, to make them seem better off than they were, started really early. She's working as a maid, and she's already trying to force her boyfriend, a Mr. William Hitchcock, to stick to her strict social rules, making him dress up formally just to walk down the street with her. And the special ends with this defining moment of social shame. Her father gets drunk and falls into the local canal.
Which, naturally, Hyacinth has to immediately spin into something else.
Exactly. To save face in front of her employers and her boyfriend, she instantly makes up a story, blames the drunken tumble on an old war injury that briefly affected her father's balance. So yeah, it successfully laid the groundwork for the character we all know, confirmed that her attempts to build this perfect social facade were absolutely lifelong.
The most tantalizing what-if nugget that the sources dug up is that uncommissioned spin-off series Mind Your Manners. This just sounds like a stroke of genius that sadly never got made.
Oh, it really does sound like a lost classic of British comedy. Roy Clark proposed Mind Your Manners right after KUA finished. And it was such a brilliant reversal of the original show's idea. Instead of focusing on Hyacinth trying to climb the social ladder, this would have been all about Onslow, Daisy, and Rose accidentally finding themselves right at the very top of it.
Okay, how on earth did the bone idol Onslow end up living in a manor house?
Well, the premise was basically rooted in Onslow taking a deliberately easy part-time gardening job, just tending the grounds of this huge old manor house estate owned by a very forgetful aristocratic old lord. The basic comic setup was just idleness meets old money decay.
And the twist that gets the sisters involved was the lord's death, right?
The twist was perfect. The old lord dies suddenly, and Onslow, Daisy, and Rose, and it's strongly hinted, Rose was having a bit of a casual fling with the deceased lord. They temporarily move into the manor house. They have to, apparently, because there's some complex legal battle over the estate with the lord's estranged, incredibly snooty brother. So they're meant to be caretakers, but naturally, they start treating the place like it's their own.
This completely flips the whole social structure. Now they are the gentry. Hyacinth's dream fulfilled, but by completely the wrong people.
Precisely. The main conflict would have been the clash between the commoners living in the manor and the neighboring aristocratic family, the Hydewhites. The Hydewhites would be absolutely furious about the common riffraff moving in next door, but, and here's the genius subplot that makes it really sing, it turns out Mr. Hydewhite, the really snooty neighbor, actually knew Onslow back in their less reputable youth.
And Onslow has some kind of hold over the aristocrat.
Total leverage. It's revealed that Mr. Hyde-White owes Onslow big time, because years ago, Onslow took the fall for some crime the young Mr. Hyde-White committed. It stopped Hyde-White getting arrested, potentially ruining his entire aristocratic future. So now the snooty neighbor has to defer to Onslow because Onslow holds the secret to his past shame. It creates this massive comic conflict where the man obsessed with social standing is completely controlled by the man who basically invented apathy.
And they'd even approached an actress for a key role in this lost classic.
They had. Sue Pollard, famous from Heidi High, same show David Griffin was in. She was approached to play Ms. Dorothy Dottie Henshaw. She'd be the eccentric, easily flustered, but very loyal cook and housekeeper who stays on at the estate despite the new, rather common, residence. Apparently some preliminary location scouting and maybe even some test shooting was done. But sadly, the project never got the official green light for a full series. It really stands as one of the great what-ifs of British comedy history.
Beyond the screen itself, KUA generated a huge amount of merchandise and some really unique commercial crossovers too, didn't it? Just shows how popular it was.
Oh, the commercial reach was vast. You had bizarre specials like that sketch Mr. Blobby meets Hyacinth Bucket in 1993, which is exactly as weird as it sounds. And both Patricia Routledge and Josephine Tucson actually reprised their roles as Hyacinth and Elizabeth for the Second Chance Shorts, which was a commercial campaign for a charity.
They even had to adapt the audio releases specifically because the visual comedy was so important.
That's right. It shows how crucial the visual gags were. For the audio cassette releases, Clive Swift actually recorded a special narrative track. He was basically reprising his role as Richard, providing spoken context to fill in the gaps for the listener, making sure the physical comedy, the sight gags, still landed even when you couldn't see them. And of course, there were the books. There was that lighthearted etiquette guide, Hyacinth Bucket's Book of Etiquette for the Socially Less Fortunate. And the director, Harold Snowd, he wrote his memoir too, called It's Bouquet, Not Bucket.
So we've covered a huge amount of ground in this deep dive. If we sort of zoom out now, the main takeaway has got to be that powerful, almost contradictory relationship between genuine artistic pedigree and massive mainstream comedic appeal.
It's the sheer, almost unnecessary depth of the cast that makes the show such a masterpiece, isn't it? We learned the woman playing Mrs. Bouquet had a Tony Award, an Olivier Award, a profound classical stage career behind her. Her husband, Richard, was an RSC veteran and a staple of serious BBC horror dramas. And the woman playing the man-eating sister, Rose, she was the original Madame Jury in Phantom of the Opera.
These weren't actors who were, like, reaching the peak of their careers in a BBC sitcom. They were highly decorated, technically flawless professionals who chose to inhabit these specific, beautifully drawn comedy archetypes. The sheer dedication they brought to these seemingly simple roles, that's what made them global icons.
And that foundation in high drama is exactly why the comedy works so well. It took that highest level of performance skill, that vocal control, remember Routledge's mezzo-soprano training, to convincingly portray Hyacinth, desperate, fragile, and ultimately quite common attempts to simply keep up appearances. They were masters playing people who desperately wanted to be seen as masters themselves. That meticulous portrayal of social aspiration, that's why the show travels so well globally.
And that profound contradiction brings us nicely to our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to maybe mull over. What does it tell us about the whole relationship between artistry and mass success that a world traveler, a celebrated dramatic and musical actress like Patricia Routledge, made the conscious choice to end her time on this wildly popular show? Not because it was failing, not because of poor ratings, but precisely because the role's overwhelming success threatened to completely define her entire legacy.
It really speaks to the terrifying power of a truly iconic character, doesn't it? Hyacinth the Bucket became so potent, so globally inescapable, that the woman who brought her to life felt she had to walk away while the show was still at its absolute peak. She recognized that the brilliant comedy archetype might permanently overshadow Dame Catherine Patricia Routledge, the Tony Award winner. It's a fascinating tension, that pull between legacy and popularity. And maybe it's a reminder that sometimes leaving the stage early, well, that's the greatest dramatic choice of all.